Good morning, everyone. While some people are still filtering in, I'm going to do the evidently necessary reminder that we would appreciate it if you turn off your cell phones. It is disruptive to the session. I know some of you just got here today, but for those of you who were here yesterday, I hope you had a great time. Word drifted back that one participant admitted publicly at about 5:15 that if he didn't go to another session, he'd already gotten his money's worth. So that was good news to all of us. I'm going to repeat a couple of housekeeping notes from yesterday because these things are very important. This afternoon, we have three-hour sessions planned. We listened to past conferees and heard that people were anxious to come and have an opportunity to actually do some work on their own writing or get some practical advice on their careers. So we developed these sessions this afternoon to provide that opportunity. But in order for them to work, everyone needs to sort of decide which session they're going to go to and commit to it, because we're not going to let people drift between sessions. So I ask you again to figure out, study your program, pick your first and second choice. A couple of the sessions will be limited in the number of people who are admitted. So figure out if there's not space left in your first choice, what your second choice is. For those of you who are going to be doing the craft round robin, we will ask you to check in here at the Grand Ballroom at the appointed hour, and you'll be given a ticket directing you to your session. So for those of you wanting to do that particular session, we have a different protocol. Want to remind you that Cambridge Transcription Services is here. That means two things for you. One is if you'd like to buy tapes, you know you want to buy tapes of some sessions that you missed. If you order them by tomorrow, you'll get a 10% discount. And also, to remind you not to stand up and bark questions out, but rather go to a microphone. We had the transcription service had some difficulty picking up some of the questions yesterday. So if you could go to a microphone and pose your question from there, that would help everyone. Someone just asked, where do you sign up? There's no sign up. You just go to the room that you want to go to, knowing that we're going to use a different procedure this afternoon and ask you all to stick with the session that you pick. We had some sessions yesterday where we ran out of handouts, and we realized that some of you may have forgotten to pick up handouts. So we are going to use the website next week. As soon as the conference is over, we're going to post the handouts, and I hope some links to some of the multimedia sites that some of you viewed. So if you go to the website next week, we'll have handouts there, and we'll have the sites. That, by the way, is only available to conference participants, sort of like your private area to pick up whatever you didn't pick up here. In your packet, in your registration packet, there is an evaluation form, which we very much would like you to fill out. We do read them, and that's why we made the adjustment and created some new sessions this time. So I'd urge you to make sure to do those by tomorrow or by the time you leave. And we also have a seminar in the fall targeted specifically for editors who want to edit narrative work. And there's a card in your packet where you can nominate yourself or someone else to attend that seminar. So please do that. It's a great opportunity for editors to come to Harvard and learn from some of the masters. Again, we'll have book signings in the bookstore at the end of the day today, and we'll have more book signings tomorrow after Sherry Turkle's presentation. I hope you guys have a great day today. And to introduce our speakers, I would like to introduce you to Jennifer McKim, who is a Nieman Fellow this year. Thanks.
Good morning. It's a great honor to be here today to present you to Washington Post reporters Ann Hall and Dana Priest. They've written many a great story, but their most recent series on Walter Reed Army Hospital exposed poor conditions, lax management, and inadequate medical treatment of wounded veterans. The story prompted immediate response and has already been awarded several national awards, including the prestigious Selden Ring Award, the Worth Bingham Prize, and the ASNE Award. The head of the USC Annenberg School of Journalists, which gives out the Selden Ring, said, "If it were not for these two reporters, our veterans would continue to suffer needlessly and unconscionably." This is exactly what investigative reporting should do: hold the government accountable to its people. What also is striking about the stories is the vivid way the Washington Post was able to detail the lives of veterans through the words and impressive multimedia presentation. It's a great example of the possibilities for storytelling in the new world. We're fortunate to have them here to talk to us about creating this investigative narrative. They'll speak for about 50 minutes, and then there'll be time for questions. As Connie said, please come up to the mic to speak, and please make your questions succinct. Thank you very much, and we'll welcome our presenters.
Thank you. So it's always a strange experience to come to these conferences because the speakers are always exalted as all-knowing. I had to practically stand in a receiving line to say hi to my friend Tom French, who is the Superman of narrative, and I promised not to touch the cape as I got too close last night. But I think Tom would be the first to tell you that when he's on deadline, he's as terrified of the process before him as we all are. And so none of us have any answers, but we did kind of want to come and share how we wrote this story. It's an honor to be back at this conference. It's a particular honor to be sitting beside one of the best investigative journalists of our generation. It's great to have her at a narrative conference. When we first teamed up, she would jokingly say, "What is this narrative thing anyway?" And too often these conferences tend to focus on the craft of writing. You know, we debate the use of language, voice, almost as if we're poets, and we often forget about the substance. Susan Orlean was here a few years ago, and she said there was a time when she was describing a piece of meat, and she was sitting at the keyboard trying to figure out how to describe the marbleized texture of the Kobe steak. And she said, "You know what, in the end, a steak is a steak." And sometimes we focus too much on the tiny and not the larger. And so we want to try and look at the practical approach to reporting and source building and writing and that kind of thing. The title of this talk is Creating an Investigative Narrative. And we never really thought of the word narrative when we set out to do this story. We didn't consciously think about the words and that you often hear at these conferences: voice, sequencing, empathy, storytelling. But in the end, all those elements ended up being in the piece. In traditional feature writing, we seek to illuminate, but this kind of journalism sought to expose and bring about change. Dana had plenty of experience as a journalist who exposed illegal deeds and wrongdoing. Her reporting on the CIA's secret prison sites around the world created a firestorm. She lives and breathes for impact. The highest impact journalism I'd ever done was making someone cry. So we really brought a couple separate approaches to our journalism. We spent 4 months working on the first set of stories. We started reporting in the fall of 2007, and the first two stories appeared in February 18th and 19th last year in the Post. And we basically focused on the Army's neglect and mistreatment of wounded soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan at the nation's premier military hospital, Walter Reed. Neither of us were prepared for the reaction that when the stories posted that Saturday night on the website around 10 o'clock, hundreds of emails started coming in. It was almost like a movie. We were sitting at the computer screen. It was like beep, 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 screen after screen filled up with emails. And for the first time in my life, after being in the business 20 years, I recognized the true power that we have as journalists to create change. And it was an electrifying experience just to see things actually happening as a result of a story. In journalism and narrative particularly, we often think about a year in the life of an AIDS doctor, hanging out with a battalion commander in Iraq. We think of highly conceived stories. This story came about in the most old-fashioned, mundane way. Dana was sitting at her desk, and the telephone rang, and she picked it up.
And the person on the line was a friend of mine, or an acquaintance, who had a friend of hers that she wanted me to meet. And because that person had something really important, they thought, to say. And it was really only because the person calling me was someone I'd known for a long time, because the subject wasn't, as it was described, wasn't anything that I was necessarily interested in as the intelligence reporter, but I went to lunch. And during the lunch, had many sort of, one half of my brain was saying, this is too good to check. The other half was sort of the jaw-dropping, how can this be true? And right from the start, my sense was that if it were true, it would be a big story. But again, there's a big if there. And why is that? Because of the huge contrast, and my brain always looks for contrast between public official statements and reality, between their behavior and reality. That's one of the reasons, you know, investigative reporters follow the money, because it can lead you in a concrete way between those two different things. So right from the start, you know, I was thinking of those two worlds, the world of everyone supporting the troops and the world of troops being mistreated and not being able to get medical care. So the initial source had just a couple names. And for me, having worked on the CIA intel beat for so long, you know, two names was a lot. And because my expectations were so low. Two real people who weren't dealing in the classified realm seemed like just low-hanging fruit. And with those two names started a process that really is very just classic, basic journalism, which is, you know, you start somewhere and you get more and you get more, and eventually you've created a network of sources. But those sources, like the beginning source, was seeing only a tiny sliver. And we could not see the whole elephant. You know, we saw the toenail and we're trying to figure out, you know, what is that? And that was one of the very big challenges overall in this story, is that it's a story of a compilation of anecdotes for us in the beginning, because we're also trying to figure out, what system are we in? What world are we working in? But right away, I went to Anne for a couple reasons. One is that I just wanted to have more fun than I was having before, and I figured if I found somebody, I didn't know how much fun she really was, but I figured I wanted someone who wasn't like me in the reporting that they do, because I could learn a lot from them and their brain would work probably differently than mine. And that was really true in a lot of important ways. And one of them was that when I approach a story, I just naturally go to look at the system. I mean, I use people to get me to a story about usually government. And I think Anne does the opposite. She writes about people and their experience, and if there's government in there, it's in the background. You know, it may be a large part of it, but really you're hearing it through the person. That takes a kind of patience that I really didn't think that I had at that point. So that's one of the reasons that that we got together. And right from the start, we decided that, because Anne had spent time up on the orthopedic ward, embedded with Army approval, we decided this isn't a story that the Army is going to allow you to do in an official way. And having covered the military for 8 years and written a book about them, I certainly knew that that was the case. So question number one was, what kind of access could we get? And One, I got a source who was inside who said, you know, just come on up. What do you mean, just come on up? Just come on up and, you know, give me your license. And so we were immediately confronted with how far can we go in this aspect? And we couldn't ever lie about who we were. And the trick was to never be in a position where somebody who you didn't want to be asking you, you know, well, who are you? So that was, that framed our whole reporting effort. But I have to say that it's not like a smooth, you know, step by step, everything goes according to plan. The first time that I went up to Walter Reed, I had already been given a map because I really wanted to know how to do this right and not get in trouble and not get found out right from the start. So I'm, you know, memorized the map the night before, looked at it again in the morning, really thought I had it down. And, you know, I go in the car, get through the gates with my license, start to drive around, and nothing is like I memorized it. And now I'm, you know, trying to not be nervous and driving not too slow, not too fast, but I can't find the damn hospital, and it's, you know, it's a huge building. And I had to stop 3 times and ask people on the road, and they were officers, you know, doctors at the hospital, and so I had to just be very calm about, you know, where is the hospital? You know, it's like, well, I learned later that there were 2 entrances to Walter Reed, and I was going through the back entrance, was the only entrance I knew at the time existed, so everything was turned around. We had one other funny incident that just says, you know, if your gut tells you to go on, you just got to go on. And that is our first reporting trip together out in the world, was that we had heard about this soldier who was fleecing other soldiers by taking them to strip joints downtown and making them sign fictitious bills and then taking the money. So we decided that we would go to that place and try to see if there were any soldiers there. And before we went, we asked one of our colleagues. We found one of our colleagues who knew of this place, and he said, you know, well, don't worry, it's not really a strip place. This is call it that, but it's not really, you know, don't worry about that. So we go there, and we took 2 big guys as our cover and looked around, and, you know, we didn't see anybody, certainly not in uniform and not even with short haircuts. And then, of course, we sit down, and 5 seconds later, these 3 totally naked ladies come out dancing on poles. So, I mean, the point is, it was a total loss in terms of a story, in terms of getting anywhere. We ended up in the intermission, you know, interviewing strippers in the bathroom, asking about our friend from Walter Reed.
So yeah, I'm standing out front waiting for Dana to get there at 10 at night by myself, and I see there's a Malaysian restaurant next door, and I see a bunch of friends coming out. They're like, hi, Ann. I'm like, hi.
But during this point, you know, I did not think a moment about writing and how anything would go from there. But I did always, and this is, again, sort of how my brain has come to work, is you have to, so I'm going to try to confirm all these different anecdotes that we eventually see. And so I'm trying to find, you know, 2 confirming sources and maybe a document for this and the same for that, and trying to kind of get control of it. And every so often, Ann would say, and I'd say, so we have, you know, this and we have that and we have, I think we're getting close to this. And she'll say, well, we'll see. You know, let's see how it goes. So there was like a very different rhythm, I think, in a way.
Yeah, she's memorizing the floor plan of Walter Reed and memorizing the blueprints, and so she's, you know, has it all in her mind. I'm like, let's just kick this old school. Let's go in there and let's spend the night in the barracks. We'll find a way to get in, you know. So the combination of my recklessness and her precision in the end sort of really worked well together. And as we proceeded in the reporting, we kind of got more on the same page, I would say, by just kind of hanging out and watching people. Yeah, so, you know, so you start out here with people on the phone, you meet them off campus, off post, and you start interviewing. We happened to talk to a lot of wives at first because they were more likely to talk. These were spouses who were just frustrated beyond belief as their husbands had languished on Walter Reed's campus for 2 years. They were at the limit, and they were really ready to talk. And so often the wives would talk to us first, and the husbands would go on board later, either on the record or off the record. And so slowly then we have to get on to Walter Reed and do the bulk of our reporting. It's a 110-acre campus in Washington surrounded by an iron fence with checkpoints to get in. That's the place we needed to see everything, to witness stuff with our own eyes so that we're accumulating all this evidence. You know, typically in narrative, we go report and hang out to sort of build scenes and describe something. This was kind of the opposite in that we needed to see things to substantiate the allegations that some of these people were suggesting happening there. Soldiers going hungry, soldiers receiving their Purple Heart by President Bush, but they don't have any underwear. I mean, the whole mythology of this sparkling golden army hospital had been, you know, alive in our minds for 5 years, and typically, the news cameras would always go to the amputee ward, and that's where Don Rumsfeld and Bush and Cheney would always go, and Hulk Hogan and politicians. But the soldiers around the country have a name for that, and they call it the petting zoo, because it's where the media is generally taken. So we needed to get out of the hospital ward and spend time on the post where the soldiers were literally being warehoused in barracks. And so one of the first places we went was this hotel on the campus there. I say campus, but on the military post. And it's called the Malone House. And, you know, prior to the war in Iraq, it had been used to house two-star generals who were recuperating from hip replacement surgery at the hospital. It looks like a Holiday Inn or a nice Ramada Inn. It's very, very nice. Chandelier, you know, oriental carpets. So we go in there, and the place is entirely jammed with wounded soldiers and Marines. It's like something, you know, it's inconceivable. They're missing limbs, they're maimed, they're burned, they're dragging IV poles, they have catheters. And so all 220 rooms are occupied by wounded from Iraq and Afghanistan, and quite often their wives and children are crammed into the rooms with them. So it's a really surreal scene. And the first night we went there, we found out that there's a bar. So while there's no social worker working in the lobby of the Malone House, there's a cash bar open every night where soldiers who are highly medicated, and many would say overly medicated, sit and drink all night. And we sat there and watched for a couple of hours. We didn't take notes that first time, obviously. We didn't want to be detected. And so we didn't quote anyone directly, but we just wanted to get a sense of this place. And so we sat for a couple of hours and kind of took it in. And I remember us leaving in silence that night, and then once we got to the car, just saying, Jesus, this is unbelievable what's happening. And from those early forays of just watching people, you kind of penetrate one ring closer to where you need to be. And we would continually go back to the bar and listen to who might have been complaining or who seemed extra frustrated. And when that soldier went away from the crowd and maybe went back to his room or went off outside to smoke, we would find a way to talk to that soldier and say, you know, we've heard there's some things going on here. We're newspaper reporters. Would you care to talk to us about it? And that's how you kind of test the water to see if that soldier wants to talk. Another concern is, will that soldier then go to his commander and say, there are two reporters hanging out here? So it was a cat and mouse game every minute of the reporting. You know, another place we would hang out is outside where the soldiers smoked. Almost everyone starts smoking in Iraq and gains a two-pack-a-day habit. So when they come back, they're smoking. So always outside of this Malone House, there are smokers. I don't happen to smoke, so it would be odd for me to go and stand there and listen. So we arranged for a friend of ours who smokes to come with us that night. And so this friend would, you know, smoke, and I would talk to this friend, and it also gave me someone to talk to and not seem so out of place. So you just kind of have to think creatively to have how to approach people and how to get stuff. And again, from these group of smokers, we ended up finding a private named Joshua Calloway, who we ended up profiling later in the year, a very long profile about his PTSD and how Walter Reed wasn't treating it appropriately. But it was from that initial session where Josh is smoking that we found him and later got him off by himself and said, would you like to talk to us? And from that, you know, I remember the night we met Josh, it was raining. We're standing out there in the rain, smoking. It's super cold. And then you get Josh to say yes, and you ask to go into his room. And so you're literally and figuratively, as a reporter, coming in from the rain. You're getting access that you want. You're sitting in his room, and you can have an honest conversation about what life is like. And that's how you build one source. And we did that very method sort of a couple dozen times with various people. And that's how you amass your sources, or as we say in narrative, your subjects or characters.
But, you know, I didn't go in looking like this. I think in all of my times as a reporter on various government beats, one of the things that I've it comes naturally, so it's not something, you know, I think I had to learn, but is empathy and respect for whatever culture you're walking into. So when I covered the Pentagon, you know, I dressed in navy blue almost every day. and I never wore open-toed shoes and, you know, didn't have red nail polish, not that I would anyway, but I just tried to fit in. That's the point. When I was in the field with soldiers, I obviously didn't wear a uniform, but I wore what I consider to be sort of a uniform, you know. And I'm sure that you all have done that when you've done immersion journalism, is that you don't want to stand out, you just want to be a fly on the wall. And so that's how we operated at Walter Reed as well. Anne was talking about the bar, which was sort of one of our first eureka moments where the world just turned upside down and we kept saying, you know, how can that be? They're on drugs. Another one was, and it came pretty early on, was a rumor about this place called Building 18, which ended up being the lead of the story and became, when television got into the mix, became the story. The first time I heard about Building 18, I just could not believe that such a place could exist. And it was always, and I was determined to get there because, you know, again, in contrast that I'm looking for, that one just was too good, you know. Cockroaches, President Bush, mold, Don Rumsfeld, you know, democracy, chaos in Iraq, you know, and it was just all there, you know. We support the troops, but we let them live with mold. And it just seemed, again, almost too unbelievable to be true. So, I had this map where the map that I used to drive in now became a different map because all the buildings were labeled on it. And before I was just trying to get to the hospital, but now I could look at all the numbers. And there was Building 18, this tiny little thing sitting actually right across from the post. And we came to learn that it was also symbolic of the overflow, that there were so many outpatients on the campus that people were stacked in hotel rooms. Pretty, you know, some of them crummy hotel rooms along Georgia Avenue, which is a pretty not great strip in Washington still. And then there was this old lodge that when you drove by it, you wouldn't even know it was inhabited. It looked vacant. And yet they were stuffing the mentally wounded in there because they figured it was too dangerous to have people who were physically wounded walk across the street, even though there was a light. So the question became, you know, how are we going to verify what's in Building 18 then, and how are we going to get into Building 18? Every interview that I did, or we did after that, there would always be, hey, do you know anybody living in Building 18? Have you ever been in there? And there weren't a ton of people because it's this pretty relatively small building, but little by little, we found people who were. The first time that I went in there, I had what I'll just say is a guide and somebody who fit in more than I did, and I didn't get too far. I got into the lobby, which looked actually not so bad, and there were soldiers milling about and could listen to them for a while, and then got upstairs into one of the hallways, and one of the soldiers who showed us what he called the VIP room, and we didn't really get it at first. It looked like, you know, it wasn't that bad, and I was sort of, you know, crestfallen in a way, thinking, how could I have heard all that and this is that? And I remember him closing the door and say, well, that's the room they show the senators. And well, what do you mean? How are the other rooms? Well, you know, wasn't that forthcoming. But the thing I still remember about that, it kept me going on about trying to get to the bad stuff in Building 18, is just his sense as we were leaving, saying, you know, we were saying, how are things going here and how are soldiers here? And he just stood there very, you know, not a forthcoming person, but he just said, you know, there's a lot of depression here and a lot of people aren't doing well. And that's all he said, but, you know, I can still see him standing there saying it. So that motivated us to continue with Building 18. One of the things that I learned in doing this story, to make a digression into, you know, lessons learned along the way, is the importance of listening. And it sounds like such a basic thing, but, you know, we're in this era of journalism in which a lot of journalists are doing the talking and often talking about derivative information. It's so critical to remember that we're not there to do that. Well, we are in some ways there to do that. I don't want to denigrate that, but the art of listening is so fundamental to what we do. And if you have a heightened ability to do that and a heightened sense of that importance, you can pick up so much. That person standing there, you know, reading his body language, not a complainer, you know, macho guy, not supposed to be wounded, not feeling comfortable enough to tell us the whole truth about the building because he didn't even know us, but there was just so much in his voice. And in the voices of a lot of people that we would start with who we didn't know their whole stories. So just, I tell myself, you know, when I start new projects, just listen. And, you know, it does pay off. The other thing I wanted to talk about a little bit is patience, which I'm sure that as a, you know, narrative writers, you're probably better at than I was. But in terms of building sources in particular, and if it's people like we were dealing with who are not going to tell you everything, they don't know who you are exactly and what you're doing exactly, and you don't want to actually tell them what you're doing. You might want to express an interest and an interest in finding out more about their life, but to be patient building those people as sources. And the question is probably going to come up, well, how do you do that when you have to churn out stuff all the time too? But, you know, I always had two tracks in my mind as a beat reporter. One was feeding the beast, you know, one was trying to do the daily journalism, and the second one was having a project. When you're asking people to go deep into their personal lives, or in this case, stand up in a small or large way against their institution, which many of them depended on, loved, you know, thought of themselves as a part of, and now they're being disillusioned by it, you know, you just can't expect that to come out right away. Or if it comes out right away in a typical, you know, soldier way, you know, fuck this, you know, just complaining, you have to know that that's part of it, is just complaining, especially when they're around everybody else, and how much of that is truth. So being patient, starting with easy questions, easy subjects, and working to the harder things. We took months to cultivate really a lot of our sources and to get what we were really after. When we spoke about Building 18, you know, we eventually got a photographer in there and went in there. I went in there the way I just described, and she went in there in a different way. But when we finally got together and had a little camera with us and was able to get through, it was like a hotel, so you had to get into the rooms. It wasn't like a barracks. And so when we finally got into a room that we had been told by a source who was taking us into the room that was a problematic room, you know, I had a camera, whipped it out pretty quickly, took pictures. But then when we were like totally excited about having gotten that far, when I took the pictures back, the photo department, and so what was I shooting? I was shooting not any people in the room, but a wall that when you turned it into a photograph, it just looked like I don't know, it kind of looked like mold if you put underneath it that there was mold, but mainly it just looked, you know, nondescript. And what I was really excited about was the hole in the ceiling above the shower, which looked like a hole in the ceiling, you know. And so the photo staff was not impressed. And, you know, I'm kind of jumping up and down, and they're like, whoa, it's a hole in the ceiling. But when they, and so the thought of having a photographer come back and do what we had just done was just out of the question. And we didn't even really want a photographer around at all. But when we got our photographer, Michael Duseal, he was amazing in what he could do and how he worked. And he eventually got into Building 18. And by that time, you know, talk about patience, we really, Jeremy Duncan, whose room we took a picture of, was someone who we had met fairly quickly, and he let us come into his room fairly quickly, but getting him to let Michael, with his big photography bag and all that, come into his room and take then a picture of him, of him standing there, that actually happened near the end of the thing. And we weren't even sure whether Jeremy would go on the record, and we never asked him until much later on, when he was very comfortable with us. By that time we had told him more and more about what we were doing and the scope of it. But it was only, you know, two months actually into it when we approached him to take a photographer. Finally, the thing I wanted to say was, you know, in real estate, location, location, location. I think in this story and in so many others, I'd say context, context, context. Because what the anecdotes that you have and the personalities that you develop and the sources that you build, to me, they obviously all have a context. But again, when you're looking at, as I often do, the contrast between rhetoric and reality, it all comes down to setting it in a context. And we could only do that at Walter Reed after understanding not only all the anecdotes and the systems, but then the larger context of the Army and the war in Iraq.
Yeah, the context thing is really important. When we took the pictures back to the post from Building 18, we thought it was such a victory. Dana particularly understood the symbolism of that more than anybody because she knew the military and she understood the context. When you contrast the picture of that cruddy room where a soldier who'd been blown up by an IED is living under this mold, when you contrast that picture with this shining promise the country, you know, has given these soldiers, it makes all the difference in the world. You know, in and of itself, as some photographer at the paper said, well, I've lived in worse places than that, but it's not in the context of the promise that Walter Reed has given these soldiers. And, you know, one way we knew that the story would come to life is, you know, describing these moments in vivid detail and not just having a source describe them for us. We needed to see as much of it as possible, which is why we asked to sleep in the rooms of soldiers and why we ate at Red Lobster. About 6 million soldiers love Red Lobster. You know, you just want to spend as much time with people as possible. And in my other kind of work, I'm used to submerging in a particular subculture and the rest of the world kind of falls away. But in this, you really need to be conscious of building sources and fostering a relationship with people who are going to pick up the phone and call and tell you something, because that's information you can use. So that by the end of the process, we probably had, you know, 10 subcontractor reporters at work for us, and they were soldiers and Marines. And it's because we kept kind of greasing those relationships, which is really traditional in her world and less traditional in our world.